Blog Talk Radio.
My daddy taught me in this country everyone's the same. You work hard for your dollar and you never pass the blame when it don't go your way. Now I see all these big shots whining on my evening news about how they're
those of you know, I have my guest tonight is going to be Dinesh D'Souza. Sorry, I'm a little mumble mouth right now. My guest is going to be Dinesh D'Souza. He is the author of The Roots of Obama's Rage. He was on Glenn Beck a couple times in the past few weeks talking about this and talking about his what his research has shown about Obama and basically what his hypothesis of what the Obama figure is and who the person is and who's behind it. So I'm just waiting on him to call in to talk about start discussing this. I set the show for a half hour. Hopefully he didn't get caught up with anything, travel, anything like that. He will be able to call it soon. I won't have to reschedule it. So let's go back to what is going on and what the main premise of the show is, his book was. Obama is this character, this perception that everybody wants to believe existed. The hope and change that we were looking for, but oftentimes we've seen, especially in recent history, the words of change and reform really mean a fundamental transformation, not fundamental restoration. So this is what Obama was actually preaching when the cameras, the bright shiny cameras of the major news networks weren't on, when he was in front of a SEIU podium saying that he's worked with SIU his whole life. He's going to continue working with SIU. He's talked to Annie Stone and Alicia Medina and all these others, and basically pledging his allegiance to a group of radicals. Oh, I have him calling me right now. Hello, Dinesh.
Hey, how's it going?
Hey, going very well. I was just explaining the premise behind your book and what the Obama perception was, but I know you can do that a lot better than I can. So if you can please introduce yourself to my audience, that would be fantastic.
And certainly, it's Dinesh D'Souza. I'm the president of the King's College in New York City and author of the new book, The Roots of Obama's Rage.
Now, what forced you, or not forced you, obviously, but what inspired you to write this book? Because throughout the whole, throughout 2007, 2008, and still till now, I've been trying to figure out, and some of others, who is this person really? Because it seems like, when someone commits a major crime, they burn off their fingerprints. That seems to be what happened. All his fingerprints were burned off, and nobody was able to find out who he was or what he was. But certain things started leaking out. Sean Hannity talked about the Belairs, Bernadine Dorn connections, and Jeremiah Wright. But then it seems that was just a little bit of the dust bunny and the whole dust bowl. Tell us more about your research and what inspired you to write this book.
Well, the thing is, I've been in California for the past 10 years before moving to New York City, and in some ways, I was a little removed from Obama for a while. I thought he was new. I thought he faced a unique set of problems. So I thought, let's wait on this guy. I'm not going to join the chorus of guys bashing him. I'm going to wait and see. And then I began to realize that, this is not a conventional liberal. He's doing stuff very different than a Bill Clinton or a John Kerry or Dukakis or even Jimmy Carter might do. Something else is going on with this guy. And initially I thought, he's a black guy and maybe he's a civil rights guy. he's embraced the civil rights idea that government is always the solution. Because in the 20th century, if you're the civil rights movement, you needed the federal government to desegregate the schools, and you needed the federal government to be a kind of employer of first resort for a lot of blacks. So I thought, you know, he's digested the black thing, and now he's applying it to all of America. But then I picked up his book, Dreams from My Father, and I began to read it. And I realized, wait a minute, this guy has not had the African-American experience. He's not a civil rights guy. That's not what moves him. He's a third world guy, like me. I mean, I'm a native of India. I grew up in Bombay. And reading about Obama's life in Indonesia with, you know, rickshaws and beggars and lepers and noise and cows crossing the road, I said, hey, this is the way I grew up. And I said, this is my world. And in a way, Obama is a much more foreign figure than Americans have realized. We're all projecting American history onto this guy, even me, but we're forgetting Obama's own history.
Mm-hmm. Now, I don't want to so much talk about, I, a lot of people talk about where he was born and all this kind of stuff. I don't want to talk about that. I don't think that's of interest to me. What's of interest is his stepfathers, his fathers, Frank Marshall Davis, his mother, his grandmother, all these people that, especially his grandmother, he harbors, Granny Sarah, he harbors mixed feelings about it, seems, every time he talks about it. Tell us about his upbringing from a philosophical point of view.
Yeah, his father is the most important figure, I believe, and you can see that in the title Obama gave to his own autobiography, Dreams from My Father. His father was, although absent from his life, weirdly present, you might say, in spirit. And the reason his father was present is his mother is the one who cultivated in Obama this larger-than-life romantic picture of his father as a great man, the Gandhi of Kenya, you know, the liberator of Africa. So Obama had this idea that his father was some kind of, hero. And only later in life did he discover that his father was actually a polygamist, a womanizer, a chronic drunk. He killed a man. He had injured himself so badly in a drunk driving accident that his legs had to be cut off and replaced with iron rods. So Obama realized his father was not the man that he had grown up to think he was, and he had a kind of crisis. But then he resolved the crisis by going to Africa, visiting his father's grave, and basically concluding, okay, my dad was a flawed man, but he had great dreams. He had great ideals, a great vision. And so Obama said, okay, I'm not going to become like him in personality, but I'm going to take his vision. I'm going to take his dreams. I'm going to take his ideology. But since his father was absent for most of his life during Obama's growing up years, he had surrogate fathers, if you will, or mentors, who taught him the chapter and verse of the anti-American, anti-colonial ideology. And that was Frank Marshall Davis. He had a couple of college professors who were radical mentors, including one guy who was a representative of the PLO, the Palestine Liberation Organization. And then later, Jeremiah Wright, Bill Ayers. So these were the guys at whose ideological well, you might say, Obama has drunk. And so he's had a very different experience than most Americans, white or black.
Now, I've been saying for a long time, not a long time, but a long time when it comes to the political scheme, because you're here, they gone tomorrow type of thing. I've been saying about Obama since he's become more public, his information about his background has become more public, that I actually feel bad for this guy. It's like he didn't have a choice. You're indoctrinated from the beginning, and he's seeking a perception, which is what people that are supporting him are doing the same thing with him. So his supporters are basically, this is dreams for my Obama or my candidate. It's kind of the same thing. It's just a cycle. But he also didn't have a chance to grow up like a normal kid. He bounced around from country to country, from school. Go ahead.
Yeah, he had a very abnormal upbringing. That's true. His father was an extremely weird guy. His mom was even weirder. Because think about it. I mean, she was a white bread girl from Kansas. She rebelled against her parents and her country. She wanted to marry a third world anti-American guy, and she found one, Barack Obama Sr. And before young Obama was two, the father, who never told her that when he married her, he was already married to a woman from Kenya. And then shortly after Obama was born, he takes off for Harvard and he takes up with a third woman, leaves Obama behind. And so you'd think Anne Obama would learn her lesson, but what does she do? She marries another third world guy, this Lolo Sotoro from Indonesia, and he yanks young Obama off to Indonesia with the mom. The amazing thing is when they get to Indonesia, she discovers over time that Lolo is becoming more pro-American and pro-Western and anti-communist than she had suspected, and so she begins to attack him and call him a sellout and a traitor, and she tells young Obama, don't be like your stepfather, be like your biological father. So here's the amazing scene. The stepfather's looking after the guy. The real father's abandoned him, and yet the mom is telling the son, you know, be like your biological father. He was a true great man. This guy's a sellout. And she packs up young Obama and dispatches him back to live with her parents, Obama's grandparents, but she doesn't go with him. So, you know, Obama's been saying, oh, I was raised by my single mother and so on. Nonsense. The father and the mother didn't raise him, neither of them. From the age of 10 till he went to college, Obama was raised by his maternal grandparents.
Mm-hmm. Now, you talked about his book, Dreams for My Father. He also wrote The Audacity of Hope, which that title in itself has a really broad story behind it as well, from the Jeremiah Wright sermon. And the Audacity of Hope Flotilla, which is, you know, the Gaza Flotilla situation that was going on in the Middle East. His book, Dreams for My Father, he revealed a lot of stuff about himself that was not made public. He talked about his Marxist leanings back then. He said that he was going after the Marxist professors and the Chicanos and all these other people that he felt were radicals or radical enough for him to associate with.
Right.
Why was this not made public? Was the media just so invested in him, or was this just not an issue for people because we're just beginning to accept socialists as, you know, part of the class?
Well, I think what happened is, Dreams for My Father is a very different book than The Audacity of Hope. That was written later when he was already thinking about politics, and so it's a much more artfully concealed book. It doesn't tell you that much about Obama. The earlier book tells you a lot about him. The thing about the media is Obama realized at a young age that he hit upon a brilliant insight into American politics. He realized that to succeed in America, you have to be not just black, but a particular kind of a black leader. You've got to be not a Jesse Jackson. You've got to be a non-Jesse Jackson and an anti-Jesse Jackson. You've got to be a black guy who, in a sense, doesn't appeal to blackness. You don't want to be pointing the racial finger at white America and saying, you people are bigoted, now pay me. So the whole racial shakedown model that Jesse Jackson has perfected, in a way, Obama realized, if I don't go that way, if I don't refer to my race, if I transcend race, not only will I automatically get black support because they'll see that I can win, I'll be the first black president, but there's a deep hunger in white America for a candidate for a black guy who is going to transcend race, who can bring us closer, if you will, to Martin Luther King's idea of the colorblind society. So no matter how radical this candidate, as long as he's not doing the racial shakedown thing, white America will go for such a guy. So Obama realized that, and he played that card beautifully. And of course, the mainstream media has been just gullibly eating from his hand. There are entire books about Obama that don't contain even a modicum of criticism of this guy, and just simply genuflecting in front of him from start to finish. So it's I think fair to say that the normal process of media checks and balances, of criticism, of vetting, this simply has not taken place. And that's one reason my book has been causing such a stir and the White House is screaming. They're just not used to somebody lifting the curtain on what the real Obama is like.
Now, the people that made this image of him, they laundered him, as Glenn Beck would like to say. That they went through the Center for American Progress, they laundered him, they made him what he was, a polished guy. And you heard this in things that Joe Biden had said, Harry Reid had said, about his blackness and how he was black, but he wasn't really black at the same time. Then you also had guys like Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson railing him and saying, you're not authentic, you didn't go through the struggle, you're not down for a struggle. Then they begin accepting him. Is he just somebody like, I mean, he would use his, you know, the union members that are doing all this dirty bidding and all the others as useful idiots. That's how he would describe them, and if the cameras are off and the tape recorders are off. Are these same people considering him a useful idiot for them?
Well, I think the Jesse Jacksons of the world are very upset with him because they feel that he has kind of taken away their livelihood. I mean, their livelihood is America is a racist society. You can't get ahead if you're black. You know, here's Obama, he's the president. That's why Jackson very angrily said to the microphone when he didn't know it was on, I want to cut Obama's nuts off, you know. And I think the reason he said that is because Obama has, in a way, cut Jackson's nuts off by discrediting the whole racial shakedown thing.
Right.
Now, that being said, I think the genius of Obama is that he is, in a way, a captive, or he's bought into a third world ideology that, if you think about it, is the product of his dad, a Luo tribesman from Kenya in the 1950s. So the big challenge for Obama is, if you have this remote and weird ideology, how do you sell it in America? And this is where I think Obama is the perfect salesman. And, you know, I don't just think he's a product of packaging, because he was a cunning, I mean, he was in a way a very well-packaged guy even when he was at Harvard Law School. He won the votes of conservatives to be the president of the Harvard Law Review because he convinced them that of all the liberals, he was the reasonable guy. So he's always had, if you will, this sort of sense, being able to convince people when he stands up and speaks that he's more thoughtful, more reasonable, more accommodating, and so he's fooled people his whole career.
Well, that's why he went up to Harry Reid and said, "I have a gift," that he's able to, what you just said, what you just alluded to, convince people otherwise than what they see, and that's what normal people, common sense people, call snake oil salesman.
You know, by the way, he got the gift from his dad, who was equally gifted in this area. Obama describes an incident at his school when he was 10 years old. And by the way, you know, Obama was not the suave, lean Obama we see now. He was an overweight, pudgy, insecure, awkward, fat kid, and he was teased not for being black, for being fat. And what he would, in order to ingratiate himself to his friends, he told them, "Oh, my father's this African tribal chief, kind of like an Indian tribal chief. He has thousands of people under him and warriors and all this stuff." So then Barack Obama Sr. actually comes to Hawaii, and Obama's teacher finds out and invites him to come speak at the school. And Obama's like, "Oh no, all my lies are going to be exposed. My father's going to come and tell my class he lives in a hut. He's going to tell them we're all poor over there. It's going to totally shatter this big lie that I've been spinning about my father, the great tribal warrior." But then his father does come. And what he does is he gives these kids a mesmerizing talk about Africa. He talks about how in the old days you had to wrestle with lions to get to prove your manhood. He talks about how the first human beings on the earth walked in Africa. He talks about the great struggles to be free. And by the time he's done, just in a few minutes, he has the whole class and the teachers eating out of his hand. So here's little plump Obama watching his dad, and he goes, "Wow, this guy's got the magic." He goes, "I've got to learn what he has." And he did. So this is why Obama himself has cultivated in himself this great ability. When there's a problem, what does he do? He stands up and speaks, and he has everyone eating out of his hand, especially the liberals, who, in a sense, have this sort of almost messiah complex about Obama, and even now are very reluctant to believe that he is taking the country down the wrong path.
Now, what is Obama's ultimate goal? Because he can win re-election. If he stops talking about his policy, he can win re-election very easily. I think we can both agree on that, because he has that ability, and no matter what he's done, he made people like him right away.
Yeah, the thing is, I think, you know, he could win re-election very easily if he were to do a Bill Clinton. If he were to move to the political center after the midterm election, no matter what happens in the midterm, if he did a Bill Clinton and moved to the center, I think he would discover that people like him, and they would probably vote to have him reelected. Now, the problem for Obama, in my opinion, is that if I'm right about him, then he's not Bill Clinton. Bill Clinton was not fundamentally an ideological guy. And Bill Clinton wanted to be popular, and once Bill Clinton realized the political tide is shifting, hey, he was happy to shift his boat in line with it. But if I'm right about Obama, then his anti-colonial ideology is deeply imprinted on his psyche from a young age. It's part of his formative development. It emerged out of the traumatic relationship with his dad. So this is who he is. And so while he can duck and weave, I mean, all politicians do that, I don't see Obama fundamentally making a change of direction. I don't think he can.
I had Roger Hope, Roger Hodge on. I don't remember if it was last week or the week prior. But I had him on. He wrote the Mandatio of Hope, and he took it from a different take. He's more on the left-leaning end of the spectrum, but he considers himself an independent, kind of libertarian ideas on a lot of things. But he was hailed as, you know, almost not a hero, but he was hailed as having done a great job by the far left and the fringe left for writing this piece on Obama and expose. I asked him how he felt about your thesis and your hypothesis on who Obama is, and he completely disagreed with you. What have you been hearing, and what disagreements have you been hearing, especially from the White House press corps and others, about why, you know, what flaws there are in your theory?
Yeah, you know, I would actually say he sounds like an intriguing guy, and I'd like to hear what he had to say about it. But I think, the White House, I mean, they're just, Robert Gibbs, the press secretary, has launched multiple attacks against the book, you know, one dumber than the next. His first one was the claim that I was somehow alleging that Obama wasn't born in America, the so-called birther issue. That's a complete misrepresentation. I mean, that's not what this book is about. It's not about where Obama was born. It's about where Obama got his ideas. So the White House stuff is just, you know, has just been, in a sense, below par. Media Matters has been attacking me, Keith Olbermann declaring me one of the most dangerous men in America. You know, Maureen Dowd, the columnist in the New York Times, has been attacking me. So there's a kind of fury on the left, but I think there's a fury because they realize how damaging this is to Obama. I mean, because if it's true, it's not just rallies the opposition. It means a lot of guys who voted for Obama had no idea what they were voting for. They didn't really vote for this. Here's a guy who's, in a sense, channeling the spirit of his dad. He's trying to, in a sense, take American wealth and transfer it to the third world. He wants to stop America from being the world's sole superpower. I mean, who wants that in America? So I think the White House has realized how lethal the argument of the book is if it holds up. And so they've been screaming. Now, there are some conservatives who have also been criticizing the book, and their argument is that, no, Obama's just a socialist, or some people think he's just a conventional liberal, kind of like Clinton or Dukakis or John Kerry. But I think that argument just collapses when you look at the data. I mean, you just have to look at what Obama's actually doing, and you realize, no, that's not the kind of thing Clinton would do. No, even John Kerry, he'd never go for that. No, this is not something even Dukakis or even Jimmy Carter would do. There's enough things about Obama that are so unique, that have perplexed not only the right but also the left, his own supporters, that you need a better theory than just to repeat, oh, no, he's just a typical liberal Democrat.
Mm-hmm. Now, when writing your book, The Roots of Obama's Rage, once again, I have Vanessa Souza on. Thank you once again for coming on. While writing your book, did you ever stop and say, whoa, you know, I can't believe that a man like this reached the stature that he did in the most powerful post in the history of the world, really. I mean, you go back to the Roman Empire, all this kind of stuff. They didn't have the influence that America, I mean, we have been on decline for a couple of years, just financial and everything, but we still have this cloud above about us. And he has the most powerful post in history. That's my opinion on it.
It's unbelievable. I mean, a set of very unique circumstances put him there. You know, if it wasn't for the economic nosedive, if it wasn't for the Republicans picking
McCain,
and of course McCain's sole strength, which is quote experience, became a liability when the whole economy went underwater. And then here was Obama, and even in the Democratic primary, you know, Obama was helped by the fact that there was accumulated Democratic hatred and embarrassment about the Clintons and all their sordid doings. And so, but the Democrats couldn't admit that because, of course, they didn't want to help the Republicans. But then along comes a Democratic alternative, Obama. And so Democratic support, almost out of a sense of relief, shifts to Obama. So this guy has had what he himself in his book, The Audacity of Hope, calls spooky good fortune. But I think his spooky good fortune is to our detriment as a country.
Now, would you classify your book as a series of jabs, a couple uppercuts, and there's a haymaker left as a finisher? Or is there anything else that needs to be said about Obama that your book doesn't cover that you know, maybe holding as a wild card.
No, I mean, yeah, my book is not a comprehensive biography of Obama. There's a lot more to be said. It's really ultimately putting a new card on the table. I mean, there are all these floating theories, you know, from the left, Obama's a civil rights guy, kind of like the new incarnation of Martin Luther King. From the right, you know, he's not a real American, or he's a socialist, he's a Muslim. And I'm saying, okay, well, look, here's something that's been missing, and that is the influence on Obama of his father, which he himself acknowledges. And so when we look at his father and what his father stood for, the anti-colonial ideology, and we apply that to what Obama's doing. I mean, look, Obama simultaneously is expanding the power of government domestically while contracting the power of America internationally. He's doing both things simultaneously. So you need a theory that can account for why he's doing that. What is he trying to accomplish? Where is he taking us? So I'm just putting this theory on the table, and I'm saying, okay, let's measure it up against the facts and see if it has explanatory power. So in a weird way, I'm not even trying to bash Obama, but of course the truth of it is, once you see the power of the theory, you're like, oh my gosh, is this what we have as our leader? So it's almost incidentally that it has lethal political implications, but it's, in a way, the book is an intellectual effort to understand Obama, not so much to crudely bash him.
And it sends a very bad message as well, from based on the reaction. I mean, it used to be for when the Republicans were in power, all you used to have to do was have a whimper, and they would just come out and just try to obliterate you and call you pansy and stuff like the neocons, obviously. And they, you wouldn't even have to really make an argument. They were just felt on the defensive all the time. It seems like the administration is not only hiding something, but trying to recreate. We talk about this revisionist history that Glenn Beck always talks about, that, you know, the progressives are trying to recreate history as we know it, and they're trying to recreate our knowledge of Obama as we know right in front of our eyes. It's a type of situation where don't feel my leg and tell me it's raining type of thing.
Well, the good thing is whatever they're doing, it's not working, because they're flinging all their Lilliputian javelins and they're just not landing. I mean, part of it is just the fact that the book, it just has a lot of new stuff on Obama. I mean, it, for example, describes this interesting article his father wrote in 1965 proposing, you know, get this, tax rates of up to 100% on the rich to bring down, if you will, these neo-colonial economic forces that he claims are dominating society. Now, you know, here's Obama, President Obama, and he says, oh, you know, the rich are not paying their fair share. But, you know, he doesn't say what the fair share is. And if you look at government data, the rich are paying a lot. I mean, the top 10% of income earners in America now are paying about 70% of all the taxes. So, you know, how much should they pay? 90%? 100%? Should nobody else pay any taxes? You know, Obama is silent on this topic, but if you read his father's paper, you're like, wow, the underlying assumption appears to be that, hey, everything that the rich people have, they've gotten by supposedly looting the rest of us, and so therefore, it's perfectly okay to take everything they've got, 100% tax rates. Now, interestingly, you know, here's Obama, and yet no major newspaper outlet, you know, the so-called New York Times, all the news that's fit to print, but apparently it's not fit to print anything about Obama's father's paper, even though it seems eerily illuminating about what this guy's been doing in the White House. So it's almost like there's a media effort to cover up for this guy, and one reason people are angry about my book is I'm sort of blowing the whistle on him.
Now, with Obama, has there been any hint of his reaction to the Kenyan socialist revolt and victory and the constitution that they passed? Has there been any kind of hint to it, you know, anything that you've
discussed? Well, I mean, there have been some reports about Obama's meddling in Kenyan politics, and honestly, that kind of stuff I pay no attention to, because I'm much more concerned about Obama's effect on America. Now, I do describe in the book how there were these different anti-colonial factions in Kenya. In fact, one of them, led by Jomo Kenyatta in the 50s, and he was the father of modern Kenya, he was the Kenyan Gandhi. But he was a free market guy. He was a pro-Western guy. I mean, his main point was, look, we don't want to be ruled by the British, but we love the democratic free market system. The problem is that Obama's father didn't agree. He was an African socialist, and he rebelled against the free market approach. And his idea was, no, the state should confiscate land, they should distribute it and create peasant cooperatives. So he had a very different philosophy, and it's that type of, you know, because sometimes people say to me, well, how can you be against anti-colonialism? America's anti-colonial. Well, I know that. I'm not defending colonialism. I grew up in India. I'm anti-colonial. We all are. The question is, what kind of anti-colonialism? Is it the free market post-colonialism that you now see in India and countries that are now coming up by making, you know, entering the global economy? Or is it the static socialist anti-colonialism of Obama's dad, a formula that's been tried all over Africa and hasn't worked anywhere it's been tried, and yet here's poor Obama, President Obama, the last anti-colonial, trying that same stupid stuff in the White House, and he's not getting any better results either.
Mm-hmm. Now, are you working on any new exposés or anything like that, or are you just kind of taking it easy right now?
I have a lot of ideas, but I can't start anything because, honestly, I've been busy, you know, basically promoting this book and defending it against, you know, its legion of critics, mainly from the left, a couple from the right. But ultimately, you know, I think that there's an originality, a freshness to this thesis. That is why the book has really struck a chord. I mean, it's a major bestseller. It was number one on Amazon. It's now number four on the New York Times bestseller list. So the reason it's creating a stir is it's put a new argument on the table.
Boy, did they hate that seeing you on the New York Times bestseller list. And I love the last 2 years, the people that they had to print on there, from Michelle Malkin, Mark Levin, Glenn Beck a couple times, Bill O'Reilly, Sean Hannity, all these people that they hate printing and they hate hitting the print button on. yourself, obviously, included. But I want to thank you once again for coming on, Dinesh D'Souza. I want to have you on again as we start getting further and after the election, to see what Obama's reaction is, and if he has a pivot point, if he has that Clinton moment, which I don't think he will personally. I think the uncertain things he'll give, but overall I don't think he's going to have that Clinton epiphany, because he also doesn't have a Dick Morris at his side telling them, listen, you want to win, you have to do this. So
yep.
that's just my feelings on it. And thank you once again. And any last words?
No, you're right. He's living in his father's time machine. I don't think he can fundamentally change. He's a little bit, to me, he's like a toy soldier who walks into the wall and keeps going. So the book's called The Roots of Obama's Rage, and I think you'll find it a good read.
Absolutely, and I encourage people to go check it out. It's Eagle Publishing. Those of you search by publisher, you want to go on their website, get a little preview. I think they give like either a free chapter read or a couple pages for you to preview. If you're a little skeptical on the material on it, but you know, this is a journalistic piece, and from many aspects, it's facts, and you know, you put a lot of time into it, and I think people should, whether they agree or not, they should go check it out.
Thanks
so
very much.
I
really enjoyed being on the show.
God bless you. Thank you very much, Dinesh.
Bye-bye.